I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. I'm one of the millions of people who read Emma Donoghue's best-selling novel, Room, about a young boy named Jack who's held captive in a cramped room with his mother. It's the only world he knows. It was made into a film that got four Oscar nominations, including a Best Actress Award for Brie Larson for her portrayal of Ma. Emma Donoghue's new novel, The Wonder, is set in 19th century Ireland and is about a poor young religious girl named Anna Donoghue who says she hasn't eaten in 4 months and is living on manna from heaven. Lib Wright, who's a nurse who served in the Crimean War, has been hired by the community to determine whether this is a miracle or a hoax. Like Room, The Wonder is about the intimacy, the relationship between a child and an adult, much of it taking place in Anna's tiny room. Emma Donoghue joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Lovely to be here, Marty.
So tell us about these fasting girls. This is this is where you got started on this novel.
Yeah, Anna O'Donnell is a completely fictional character, but there are about 50 real cases that kind of haunt this book. They were known as the fasting girls or the miraculous maidens. And, you know, 50 is not many at all. This is 50 over about five centuries. They're found all over the Western world. And they weren't ever a homogenous group. They are basically people who hit the headlines for being apparently able to live without food. There'd be the occasional young man in there, occasionally an older woman, but most of them were girls or young women. And some of them were overtly religious. Some of them would say, you know, God feeds me, I don't need food. Some were Protestant. And some were Catholic. They all seem to have been Christian, as far as I know. But some of them didn't make any religious claims at all. They just said, it's amazing, I live on light or I live on air. So I see them as a kind of a recurrent cultural fantasy of ours.
Was there one case or one person, one girl in particular, that you use for this story?
I drew on several, but the one I first heard about a good 20 years ago was a Welsh case called Sarah Jacob. And what horrified me about that case was that the media got involved, and in this sort of scientific spirit of the 19th century, they wanted to, you know, test whether the girl was a hoax or not. So they brought in nurses and they had the girl strictly watched, and she died. So in that case, clearly the experiment made what it was looking at worse. You know, the scientific observations somehow changed the terms of what was going on in that house, so the girl died. So I couldn't tell that story. It was too dark even for me. But it always stuck in my mind, and over the years I became aware of more and more cases. There was a famous one called Molly Fancher in Brooklyn, for instance. Some of these young women ended up, you know, in hospitals getting force-fed. Some of them were found out as hoaxes. Some of them were never found out and lived on for several decades claiming to be just fine without food. So there are a real mixture of cases. But with this particular story of Anna O'Donnell, I wanted to set it in 19th century Ireland, not just because Ireland is my own home country, but because the Irish, the great famine of the 1840s is really part of our psyche. We are the people who survived famine, you know, we pride ourselves on that. So I really liked the idea of setting this story of voluntary hunger against the background of the involuntary hunger.
To create a kind of tension between this young girl who chooses not to eat in a country at that time where people were starving because they couldn't eat, that kind of tension?
Yes, and of course that's true of modern eating disorders too. That's the terrible paradox of them, that people can starve in a country where there are ample calories. It's two very different forms of hunger. And also the mid-19th century was a perfect time to set this story, because over the whole range of the last five centuries you see a lot of different explanations of these cases, and typically religious explanations dominated at the start. You know, if you were fasting in 1500, they would say, oh, you're probably a saint. If you're fasting in 1950, they would probably say you had a mental disorder. And in the mid-19th century, you could say any of these things. And, you know, you could also say that somebody was a medical anomaly. So there were lots of different ways of interpreting this kind of case. And I loved the idea of this young child, Anna O'Donnell, who's only 11. You know, in a way, she's this little blank page. She's an enigma, and everybody has a different theory about her.
Well, it's the 21st century, so it's hard not to think about anorexia, the idea of denying yourself food. There's a certain weird kind of control and power, I think, that someone has when they deny themselves food. It's sort of a strange kind of power, because clearly they're they're weakening their own selves, but in doing that, controlling the world around them.
Absolutely. I'm very interested in the power of the powerless. And, you know, Anna O'Donnell, as a child in Victorian Ireland, you know, she'd never have a job, she'd never have a vote. Her prospects were really limited. But the idea that just by saying no to food, she could end up as a celebrity with, you know, visitors coming from other countries, people offering money. And you see that sometimes in situations nowadays of, say, reality TV, where people put themselves through horrendous experiences, yes, all to get famous, all to be in that spotlight. So I was fascinated by the psychology of Anna and of everyone around her as well, because, you know, if it takes a village to raise a child, I think it can take a village to damage one too. So I'm really interested in the kind of, you know, ethical ripple effect of this case and all the people in Anna's life, her parents, her relatives, her priest, her teacher, her doctor, all these people who are failing to save her until this outsider, Lib Wright, an English nurse, comes in. And Lib has been assigned simply to surveil Anna, you know, to be strictly neutral. But of course, as any medical professional will tell you, there's no such thing as being strictly neutral.
Well, she's an interesting character, Lib, in that she's a nurse. She trained under Florence Nightingale. She served in the Crimean War. She's a widow. I mean, she has lived a hard life herself.
Yes, I wanted to give her an interesting background, which would make her, you know, feel equipped for any situation, right? She's the Nightingale nurses were an absolutely new breed. You know, nursing had been the most low job. It was like scullery maid. So to have served in the Crimean meant that you were suddenly part of a new batch of highly trained, zealous, idealistic professionals. And so Lib Wright is going to think that she's seen everything before, but she has not seen this, and she's baffled by the case. And it's partly because she's so English and educated and middle class and rational, she's actually not very well equipped to understand rural Ireland. Because, for instance, on the second day of the watch, she finds a saucer of milk under a dresser, and she thinks, aha, this is how the girl's being secretly fed. But no, it's milk that's been left out for the fairies, as any Irish person would have known. So, you know, she's a bit like a highly trained professional sent by an NGO to sub-Saharan Africa, and bewildered and making lots of mistakes because she doesn't have that cultural knowledge.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me have you do a reading from your new book. And this is Lib is meeting
This is her first encounter
Anna
with Anna O'Donnell.
Time.
Yeah, yeah. She carried on lifting one piece of clothing at a time. Even if Anna was a fraud, there was no need to mortify her. The girl shivered, but not as if embarrassed, only as if it were January rather than August. Few signs of maturity, Lib jotted down. Anna seemed more like 8 or 9 than 11. Smallpox vaccination on upper arm. The milk-white skin was dry to the touch, brownish and rough in places. Bruises on the knees, typical in children. But those tiny spots on the girl's shins, blue-red, Lib had never encountered them before. She noticed that same fine down on the girl's forearms, back, belly, legs, like a baby monkey. Was this hairiness common among the Irish by any chance? Lib recalled cartoons in the popular press depicting them as apish pygmies. She remembered to check the calf again, the left one that was indented. It was as flat as the other now. Lib glanced through her notes. A few troubling anomalies, yes, but nothing that lent weight to the O'Donnells' grandiose claims of their daughter's 4-month fast. Now, where could the child be hiding her food? Lib compressed every seam of Anna's dress and petticoats, feeling for pockets. The clothes had been darned often, but well, a decent kind of poverty. She checked each part of the girl's body that could possibly hold the tiniest store, from the armpits down to the crevices, cracked in places, between the swollen toes. Not a crumb. Anna made no protest. She was whispering to herself again now, lashes resting on cheeks. Lib couldn't make out any of the words except for one that came up over and over and sounded like Dorothy, could it be? Roman Catholics were always begging various intermediaries to take up their petty causes with God. Was there a Saint Dorothy? What's that you're reciting? Lib asked when the girl seemed to have finished. A shake of the head. Come now, Anna, aren't we to be friends? Lib regretted her choice of word at once because the round face lit up. I'd like that. Well, then tell me about this prayer I hear you muttering on and off. That one 'tis not for talking about, said Anna. Ah, a secret prayer. Private, she corrected Lib. Little girls, even honest ones, did love their secrets.
That's Emma Donoghue with a reading from her new novel, The Wonder. That's true. Thank you so much for that reading. There is so much going on in those couple of paragraphs there, including the skeptic, the nurse, the outsider, the Englishwoman, And the, what, fanatic? The religious, it's a little girl, so it's hard to describe a little girl
like
a fanatic.
But I also tried to make her a very normal little girl. You know, I watched my own daughter, who's nine, and I thought, okay, my daughter's growing up in a setting where she's really very free, but if she was in a world of groupthink, like Irish peasant Catholicism in the 1850s, how might she absorb the rules around her and decide to apply them to herself as extremely as possible? If she wanted to be a good girl, how would you be the ultimate good girl in 1859 in Ireland? So I tried to, you know, use the kind of body language of any girl and even some of the conversational rhythms of any girl, and to make Anna, you know, as best she can, a normal and natural little girl, except that she has this absolute fixation, which is that she mustn't eat, doesn't need to eat, that she is beyond eating.
And of course, that's impossible. I mean, it's impossible for anyone to not eat for 4 months. So there's obviously not only Lib's doubt. As a reader, we're doubtful, we're skeptical. This can't be true.
And I tried to give the novel not just the kind of basic suspense of, you know, how is she managing? What's going on at a sort of calorie level? But I wanted to ask the deeper question of why all this is happening. And I didn't want to make it a simple one-line solution. You know, I wanted to make it a complicated and muddy case with all sorts of factors involved, psychological and religious and family-based and even national, you know, the Irish psyche. I read a lot about how famine leaves its mark on cultures, a very interesting study of Ethiopia as well as Ireland, that said that after famine, people quite often develop this sort of I don't need food attitude. You know, people will conspicuously, you know, let the crops in their gardens go to waste as if to signal to the neighbours, you know, we're not so desperate that we need to harvest that vegetable. So it's very interesting how irrational we all are about food, frankly, and about health. I mean, in researching this book, I was struck that, you know, nowadays people love to believe in miracle cures as well. There's always some new berry mentioned on Facebook that will transform your life, or a terror of, say, vaccinations. So I think health and the body is a matter that we can rarely be rational about.
Well, Anna has a vaccination.
She does.
I noticed you gave her one.
Yes, because, you know, there was no particular objection to vaccinations in the 1850s. They were just, you know, clinging to their medieval patterns in other ways. But yes, they included vaccinations. I love those moments in historical fiction that are a real mixture of the modern and the timeless. You know, I like moments where your readers are listening to your main character and they're thinking, oh, yeah, you know, this is universal stuff. And then suddenly there's a moment when the character has, you know, some flash of prejudice or something. And we as 21st century readers, we back off, you know.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Emma Donoghue is our guest. Chances are you read one of her previous books, Room, and she's got a new one called The Wonder. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Time. She's written a number of other books, Frog Music, Slammerkin, The Woman Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, Inseparable Desire Between Women in Literature. We are talking not only about this particular story, but also talking about Ireland in the 19th century. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Emma Donoghue about her new book, and it is just out, and it is called The Wonder. As I was reading your book, I was also thinking of those fairy tales, which are about eating, generally eating children. Think of Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood. There are other stories as well about little children getting eaten by adults. And I don't know whether that figures into some of your writing or some of your thinking.
You know, fairy tales figure in all my writing. Yeah,
I figured.
I particularly like writing stories which are you know, are committed to realism. You know, they're a particular time and place. They're detailed. They're convincing. They're naturalistic, but they have something kind of archetypal as well. You know, I like the fact, the idea of a legend or a fairy tale or some, you know, deeper story that could have happened anytime, any place, a kind of throbbing underneath the surface of a particular realistic story.
And I remember reading fairy tales to my son when he was little and realizing sort of for the first time just how scary they were. As a little girl, I don't think I experienced them that way. But as an adult reading them to a child, you realize, whoa, what? And then you tell them to go to bed, go to sleep.
You know, but they want these stories.
They do, I mean, absolutely.
The oral tradition is like a great series of likes all through history. You know, if people didn't like these stories, they wouldn't have passed them on. So, yeah, I think it's no accident that a lot of stories focus on these sort of basic terrors of, you know, do you starve in the woods? Do you get eaten up yourself? You know, and the dangers of eating even. I'm thinking of Persephone in the underworld. She has a couple of seeds and she's trapped there.
And also how, and this is not nearly as dramatic as what we've been talking about, but I think for every parent, when they find their child won't eat, I mean, just how infuriating that can be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes it goes on for more than a meal or two. Sometimes it seems like it goes on for days.
Yeah. And I mean, so many of us would say that, you know, that the parental job starts with feeding them even before they're born, you know, get food in them. I sometimes tease my kids by saying, listen, you know, you're made of me, right?
Right, right. In fact, your book is dedicated for our daughter, Una, an old Irish blessing. May there be no frost on your potatoes nor worms in your cabbage. Does that go back to the 19th century, this really difficult?
Oh, yeah, that's an ancient proverb. But, you know, Una objected to the details of that. She was glad to be the subject of my dedication, but she said she doesn't like cabbage. She would have preferred a proverb that was about foods she likes. But, you know, they didn't do proverbs about mac and cheese or hot dogs.
But you did set this in this really terrible time in Irish history when the not just the potatoes went bad, but it was clear that the English were you know, sending crops overseas so that it just made it impossible for people to either live or even barely survive.
Yes, it's interesting. I tried to draw kind of a subtle parallel in this book between, you know, what's happening in this individual case where all these people are gathered around this girl and just sort of neutrally watching her. And of course, that neutrality, it's no such thing. So they're effectively letting her head towards death. But similarly with laissez-faire economics, you know, that Irish mass death was really brought on by British policies. So I was very aware that Ireland, that Anna can sort of stand for Ireland as well as for herself. Yeah, and in a sense, she can stand for all women as well. I mean, one scene that struck me as having very contemporary overtones is that there's a scene where the whole committee who've hired the nurse gather to discuss Anna's case. And there they are, you know, debating the rights and wrongs of what's happening. And nobody's stepping in to actually save the girl. Mm. And, you know, in Ireland, we have similar battles at the moment over things like reproductive choice. You know, Ireland still doesn't have reproductive freedom. So, you know, the idea of this committee of men weighing in on what they think should happen to the girl's body, it's not dead and gone. So many of these issues are still alive and well.
And in many ways, this book is about this girl's body. It's wasting away. There's some sort of mystery about obviously why and how this is going on, how she can live and also not eat at the same time, which of course is impossible.
Yeah, and I wanted to put the nurse in a peculiarly difficult position in that, you know, nurses in those days were particularly under the thumb of doctors. They were really not meant to take any independent decisions. They were, you know, meant to kind of cheer and help the patient as much as they could. But in this case, she's not allowed to do the most basic thing the girl needs, which is give her food. So she's really, she's a zealous nurse, but she's in the position of a prison guard. And then, you know, she finds herself, one doctor advises her to force feed the girl. So, you know, there are all these ethical miseries for her around this case that she starts to really like this girl and want to help her, but can't figure out how to do it. And I really liked the idea that both the medical professionals and the media in this book both have to go through a similar dilemma, because there's a key character who's a journalist. And again, he's meant to be just reporting on the case. And he starts off very sort of cynical and worldly and just making fun of it as a nonsensical case. But he too starts to care. He starts to feel committed. And because he's an Irishman, but a very rational and educated one, he's a kind of an interesting bridge between those two very, very distinct traditions of the, you know, superstition-bound Irish peasantry and the rational English. You know, he's a complicating factor.
And where are you between those two poles?
I'm much more of a skeptic, but on the other hand, I absolutely see how religion can buoy people up, you know, the sheer strength and uplift it could give to powerless people like the Irish peasantry in the 19th century. I mean, it was a religion that told them that, you know, the last would be first and the meek would rule, and that, you know, a little Irish girl might be as important as the Queen of England, and that all things would be reversed in the next life. So I can see how totally consoling it was, and it gave meaning to their days, meaning to all their sufferings and deaths, meaning to every sick or dying child. So I can absolutely see why they clung to it. But I can also see the sinister effect that it had when it became a system of, you know, groupthink, a system of rules and counting prayers and very, very petty rules.
Do you see Anna, this little girl, I mean, as sort of representing a kind of fanaticism that we sometimes see in religion?
Yeah, and a real, you know, a wasted opportunity. You know, she's an intelligent, idealistic young person. You know, she reminded me of teenagers who get radicalized and go off to join ISIS today.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. I was very aware that, you know, you could have set this story in any cult or religious setting where the rules are very extreme. A girl in India has just died at 13 after a 68-day complete fast. You know, she's in the Jain tradition. So it's not just Catholicism. I could have set this story anywhere, but it seemed most honest to set it in my own cultural tradition. You know, if you're going to be saying really tough things about a cult, culture, it might as well be your own.
And your faith, I know you were raised Catholic.
I'm not Catholic anymore, but it certainly marked me. Yeah. And I take religion very seriously. It's just that I hate fundamentalism in any form. You know, I hate when any system of rules, and, you know, it could be communism, it doesn't even have to be a religion, when any system of rules becomes so rigid that there's no room for the individual, or where there's no room for, you know, the body, for human needs, for human impulses and appetites.
And it marked you how?
Well, I think people are always asking me about national differences in my audiences, and I rarely notice them much, but certainly in Ireland, people still talk about religion very freely and openly. You know, it's just one of those things that comes up, whereas in other countries, especially England, I would find, you know, religion is a bit of a no-no, you know.
Oh, and how about this country? Or how about Canada, where you live?
Not quite as afraid of the subject as the English, but they wouldn't still discuss it quite as comfortably as the Irish would, yeah. I find that, you know, religion comes up in some of my books, but not others. It's a bit like some of my books have lots of sex scenes and many of my books have no sex scenes. I don't have a common policy on these things. It's all a matter of what the characters find important and interesting. So in this book, because the characters are obsessed with matters like, you know, how many prayers do you need to say to get somebody's soul out of purgatory? So religion and the details of religion come up a lot. And I was quite surprised in my researches that a lot of these things that I would have thought had sort of died out by now have not at all. So I found a website, for instance, in which people log the prayers that they are praying to get souls out of purgatory. And they're, you know, it's like a modern database, but, you know, it's collecting information about this ancient impulse to pray somebody out of purgatory. I found a website in which people ask to become martyrs, not to actually die, but to suffer as much as possible within their lives. So I think this particular strain of religion, the kind of anti-body, anti-pleasure, anti-sex, anti-food strain, has never quite gone away.
I mean, an anhedonia, right? A fight against pleasure itself.
Indeed, yeah. So, for instance, one of the core texts I looked at was the Imitation of Christ. And I found that just repellent. You know, the sheer, you know, let's destroy the flesh so that we can get to the spirit. I mean, I think the wonderful thing about human beings is that we are both, you know, we're flesh and spirit. So, you know, just as I would hate any movement to say, we have no spirit, let's just shop till we drop. similarly, I think to want to shed the body any earlier than we will naturally lose it anyway through death, I think is utterly perverse.
I mentioned the fact that I was one of the millions that read Room, and there are, I don't want to overstate it, but there's some interesting little parallels between the story and Room, in that we have this very intimate, intense relationship between an adult and a child, or a caretaker and a child, and also just the intimacy of where this drama takes place. And at one point, Lib, who's the nurse, says, it's strange to feel so yoked to another person. They're in Anna's bedroom, and essentially together, their knees are practically touching. It's obviously a tiny room, not unlike
But the
room.
Difference is that it's not locked. They're in there because Anna is saying no to food, saying no to life, saying no to the world. So I think in a way I wrote this book in reaction to room. I was interested in what happens if you lose your freedom, not because some outsider has shut you in, but because your own mind makes those walls. So it's about psychological entrapment rather than literal entrapment. And also in Room, I'm looking at the relationship between a mother and the child she's given birth to. So it's kind of obvious right. and automatic how close they would be. In this case, the mother of Anne O'Donnell is quite a sinister figure. And instead, I sort of wanted to test that traditional family bond against the brand new bond that springs up between this nurse and this child. They only know each other for 2 weeks, but it changes their lives. So it was a kind of a, you know, weighing up different forms of fondness between adults and children, different forms of responsibility as well. I mean, is somebody still a mother if they're failing to save their child? You know, no. Is a father still a father if he's just kind of gently drifting and waiting? Yeah, this book does take some of the same elements as Room, but kind of probes them.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, is a mother or a mother or a father if they're not saving their child? You asked that, but I'm asking you back.
Well, I can certainly think of many cases where, you know, I think people's, you know, original rights to their child have been lost. Yeah. I mean, there was that photograph on the internet recently of a couple found both slumped over in heroin-induced overdoses in the front seat of their car. And, you know, you could see the feet of the child in the back strapped in, waiting. And, you know, I showed that photo to my kids and I said, I hope those parents lose that child. Mm. You know, I mean, you know, we all make mistakes, yes. But at a certain point, I think you've broken your claim on a child. I think the child has just as much of a right to be truly looked after and truly loved as the birth bond is.
Well, in this case, I mean, people come to this little girl, Anna, thinking it is a miracle. I mean, pilgrims come to kind of pay homage to her.
Yes, I was fascinated by the kind of, you know, the fandom around these fasting cases, you know. I do think, in a way, we all have that tendency, you know, when we read about some terrible case in the papers, there's a morbid curiosity and there's a wish to get some kind of excitement from the sufferings of others, and also to we prize the rare or the freakish, yeah. You know. And even as a writer, I'm very aware of that. You know, I do that myself. I find you know, stories of the extremely rare are very good for illuminating the everyday. But occasionally, I do feel like a bit of a vulture on the freakish.
Do you really?
Throughout history, I do at times. I'm aware of my particular forms of curiosity and obsession, you know.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Emma Donahue, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Author of Room came out just a couple of years ago, and she's got a new book. It's called The Wonder, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And if you want to join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Talking about this relationship between parent and child, I just have to say that what moved me so much about Room was just the fierceness of the love between this mother and child. And in the room, she creates this world for him, for Jack. And in the outside world, he sort of creates a world for her once they escape. I mean, he's obviously instrumental in her escape, but while she kind of saves him in the room, I feel like outside in the world, he saves her.
Yeah, there's an element of taking turns to it, isn't there? Mm. One thing I love about the parent-child relationship is that it's never static, you know? Really, in any given year, you have to renegotiate it because they're a bit older and you're a bit older and they're a bit more independent and you have to loosen those reins. So while it doesn't always feel reciprocal, you know, if you're there cleaning up and saying to them, go to bed and making their school
and they're
lunch,
giving you the finger or
exactly,
something like that.
Exactly. It can right. feel a bit one way. But you know, it never stays the same for long. And within the story of Room, I really wanted to allow Jack to, in a way, take all that he's been given and find in him the strength to help his
yeah.
mother.
Yeah. yeah. We were talking about this before going on the air. You were pleased with the film?
I was.
And actually were involved in the film.
Yeah, yeah. I was the screenwriter. So I think that meant I didn't experience any of the changes or sort of translations as, you know, an attack on me. I was there for all of them. I was negotiating all of them. So I was thrilled with the result. Yeah, yeah. I never wanted the film to stay exactly like the book. I just, mm-hmm. I wanted it to keep the book's structure, which is very unusual for a film. I was afraid somebody would stick in a big flashback, or they'd make it a kind of a crime film or a thriller, or that we'd have to sort of go to the courtroom and confront the abuser. So, you know, I didn't want it to become conventional in any of those ways. And the director I worked with, an Irish director, Lenny Abramson, he was just so unafraid of the unusual aspects of the project. For instance, in the book, the little boy has long hair because he's never bothered to cut it. He's like his mother, you know, she's got long hair. And as soon as I started writing the screenplay, which I did actually before the novel was published, I said to myself, visually speaking, on a screen, the long hair is going to be so distracting because people will be so focused on his androgyny that they won't see that he's just like a regular little boy. So I immediately gave him short hair in the script. And then the director said to me, I liked the long hair. It's a good kind of marker that he's been raised a bit differently. Let's go back to the long hair. So he was fine with that. Now, Jake Tremblay, our wonderful child star who was 7, he couldn't stand it. Not because it was long hair, but because it was a wig. It was a really fancy wig.
Oh, it's a very good fancy wig.
Every day he had to have this fitted on. It took about an hour of his morning. And, you know, no little boy wants to sit still for the fitting of a wig.
Absolutely.
So we were filming, making the film in order. Like, this is so unusual. We did it because it made a lot more sense to the child. So we were filming it more or less as it happened. And when we got to the point where Joan Allen cut the hair, the child was in short hair from then on. He was so relieved. And Joan Allen, you know, she was genuinely nervous in that scene. Her hands were shaking because the wig was very expensive. You couldn't retake that shot.
She did a very good job.
She did.
Is there a certain pleasure in literally seeing then actors speaking the words that your characters
pleasure.
In a
and
book would
you know,
say?
You don't even mind if the words they speak are a bit different from the ones you've written, because we used improvisation a lot. When you're working with a small child, you want to get a totally natural vibe. So sometimes Lenny would get them to kind of, you know, run a scene improvising around the words I'd written. And I would have thought that I'd find that, horrifying. But actually, we were aiming for such naturalism that I was delighted. He kept saying to me, let's make it like a sort of wildlife documentary. If we're just peeking at these people living their lives.
I love that wildlife documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Emma Donoghue, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We've been talking about a previous book of hers called Room. It was a bestseller, actually a finalist for the Man Booker Prize. And she's got a new book just out, a novel about a young girl who claims that she hasn't eaten for 4 months. It involves a nurse who comes in to watch her to see how she manages to stay alive. And the new novel is called The Wonder. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. There's a phenomenon called fasting girls. These were girls in previous centuries denying themselves food as an act of religious faith for many of them. Some people thought it was a sign of a miracle. Some others thought it was a sign of a hoax. And our guest Emma Donoghue was intrigued with some of these accounts and has used them as the basis for her new novel, and it's called The Wonder. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email from Catherine. She writes, I feel you are glorifying eating disorders. The girl called Anna is the name girls give when they fall into anorexia. This becomes their dictator, their inner critical voice, and this is what it is, a terrible inner critic which controls their life and has an incredible fatality rate. Fictional though it is, it can impact young girls tremendously. I hope I am wrong.
You're absolutely right about the word Anna. That's why I chose the name Anna for this girl, because when I was doing my researches, which included a lot of reading into eating disorders today, I was just repelled by these pro-Anna websites. That's A-N-A. I had known a bit about eating disorders, but I had never imagined that there was this kind of cult to celebrate them, you know, and pictures which are called thinspiration, where they will share photographs of gaunt, gaunt celebrities. It's just revolting. I think my cheerful demeanor might be giving a false impression that this book is in any way celebrating this girl's fast. It's a study of a tragedy in action. It's a study of a nurse desperately brainstorming the situation, trying to figure out how to save this little girl from her kind of self-imposed dictator, as you put it. The book is all about how it happened that this particular girl ends up saying no to food, yeah, and the many, many crippling psychological factors and religious elements and national elements that lead her to make that decision. I don't think if you read the book, it could be described as in any way celebrating eating disorders. And I was always aware that this phenomenon of the fasting girls, it's not exactly the same as anorexia today in that it took different forms in different cultures. So in previous centuries, these young women tended to emphasize purity and sort of strength and self-control. So those aspects of it, they didn't tend to talk about being thin or being attractive. But I still see a huge amount in common between eating disorders today, which are ravaging so many people and young men as well, and not even just young ones. I still see a huge amount in common between them and these previous ones. It's just that in previous cultures, in previous times, they tended to put it in the language of religion. But there's an appalling kind of continuity from medieval saints like Catherine of Siena, who's described as, you know, poking her throat with a twig to make herself throw up. You know, I mean, you read something like that and it just gives you the shudders because it reminds you so much of what, you know, teenagers I know are going through today.
Well, and we haven't talked a lot about Lib and her observations, her frustration, her skepticism. And as you have indicated several times, even her surveillance in a way hastens the tragedy of this particular story.
Yes, and one of the things that inspired me when I was writing this, you know, sort of tortured nurse is I read a lot about, you know, families and what they go through when they're trying to help a loved one with eating disorders and how they're torn between these different theories, you know, like the theory that it's all about, you know, a family having controlled a girl too much, so they should back off, let her be free, you know, just leave it to her and her therapist. And then other programs that say, no, you have to intervene, you have to, you know, take steps to take that decision out of your child's hands and say, we insist you eat, you know, that the eating as medicine sort of theory. So, you know, I could see that the family of somebody with an eating disorder is going through agonies over the best way to help them. And it all depends on things like what age the person is and what their particular reasons for ending up in this situation are. So in a way, I see The Wonder as a kind of a medical ethics thriller, that the nurse is by the main doctor in charge, she's told, do nothing, just watch, it'll be fine. And then one doctor visits and says, this is ridiculous, you should be force feeding this girl immediately. And these are issues that still come up today. The whole question of the will of an 11-year-old and how much they're allowed to consent to or refuse medical treatment. I mean, you see it in cases of, say, families who don't believe their children should get blood transfusions. And often we outsiders are horrified and we're thinking, you know, that we want to break that parent-child authority and intervene. But, you know, we also have to ask ourselves what the child wants and at what age can you consent to things. These are agonizing issues.
And whether to believe a child. I mean, that's
Absolutely.
What I also kept asking as I was reading, which is, do I believe her? Do others believe her? Does Lib believe her? Should we believe her? When a child speaks, do we believe them?
Yeah. And Lib as a nurse kind of swings between, you know, irritation and judgment of this child and an assumption that this girl is a cynical hoaxer doing it, say, for the money. And then on the other hand, she's responding very warmly to the intelligence of the child and the idealism and sincerity of the child. So she's always kind of looking for a villain, and there's no one villain in this book. It's more kind of terrible cluster of forces.
Your descriptions of Ireland at this time period are vivid and beautiful. I mean, and it's such an interesting, I guess, contrast to the world that Lib has lived in, clearly outside of Ireland. But did you have a particular place in mind as you described the bogs? And
just an area. I remember as a teenager, you know, hopping out of the car and setting off for a walk, and I took two steps onto that spongy bog and I fell full length and I was soaked immediately. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is like some weird sponge planet, you know. It's not ordinary land that you can walk on. So, I think the bog is also a very interesting landscape because it preserves things, you know, those beautiful, you know, ancient bog bodies that have been found there that Seamus Heaney wrote about. Many of our treasures, like the Book of Kells, have been found wrapped up in bogs. So the bog preserves. The bog is a kind of a, you know, it's an enormous book. It's a memory device. And yes, in a way, I wanted this book, although full of miseries, I wanted there to be flashes of beauty. You know, I never wanted to forget the pleasures of life, because in a way, what's so haunting is the idea that Anna O'Donnell might say goodbye to all this, that she might turn her back on it. So that's the tension of the book, is whether basically the nurse can find some way to save this girl whose worldview has so little in common with the nurse's. You know, she has to find that point of human connection and save her from an entirely sort of self-imposed grim fate.
You grew up in Dublin.
I did, yeah. And although I didn't grow up in a very, you know, either superstitious or heavily religious setting. I mean, we were Catholics, but we weren't the kind who were always falling to our knees and saying the Angelus. But still, there were elements in my culture that I've drawn on for this book. I remember, for instance, in 1981, when I was a child, the Republican prisoners in jails in Northern Ireland, they went on a hunger strike. Several of them fasted to death for the right to
Bobby
be treated.
Sands, huh?
Exactly. So I remember very early on being struck by the kind of paradox that you could be a totally powerless prisoner wearing a blanket, and yet the world could be paying close attention to you because of what you were suffering, and whether or not it was fair to use this tool. And I think both Ireland and India have these long traditions of fasting as a political act. And I also thought a lot of the suffragettes, for instance, they did a lot of hunger strike as protest too. So something else that happened in my teens was Ireland had a rash of what were called moving statues. People were convinced that they saw holy statues move. So people would go in large groups and stand there in a field staring at a particular statue of the Virgin Mary until somebody thought they saw it move or cry or weep tears of blood. So, you know, this stuff was in no sense over in 1980s Ireland. And I think as a Dublin teenager, I was rather horrified by it all. And I felt like, oh, you know, I want to join the modern world. What is this country I'm trapped in?
And yet you were sent, and perhaps this is very conventional, to a convent school in Dublin. That's where you went to school.
The nuns ran all the schools. Yeah,
there was just
a standard
choice
free
in the matter.
Government-funded school, but run by nuns. And I have to say, those nuns did a great job of sort of keeping a very disciplined school. I mean, as a sort of swotty, hardworking student, I was kind of delighted that the nuns were keeping everything so disciplined, even if I, you know, resented them at the level of the individual nun sometimes.
But you liked the fact that it was a tight ship?
It made a tight ship, yeah.
And were you a good student?
I was, yes.
Say that with a bit of mournfulness.
I never had a wild youth, never. I've just been sort of head down reading and writing since I was about five.
And your father's a critic.
My father's a critic, yes.
A rather
he's
well-known
still writing,
critic.
Yes. Dennis Donoghue, who taught at NYU in New York for many, many years, and he's still publishing in his late 80s. So he makes me feel I'm hardly prolific at all, and I'll have to work a lot harder than that to keep up.
Were you writing all the, I mean, as a little girl, reading?
Yes, I learned to read early, and it was a house of books, and I was writing poetry from seven, and my dad's books of criticism used to turn up every now and then, and it seemed normal to me. Every now and then a box turns up and it's books with your name on it.
And would you read your dad's books as a kid?
No, I would not. They were far too difficult.
So what did you like to read as a child?
Oh, you know, I think my choices were fairly conventional. Lots of fairy tales, lots of good children's literature, you know, C.S. Lewis, for instance. And then I had a big science fiction phase in my teens, and historical fiction as well. I used to read the rather trashy Jean Plaidy novels about Henry VIII, and I'd sort of make up plays about them. So the point is that I read voraciously, and, you know, I even had a comics phase. I, you know, seeing my own children now, it's wonderful to just let them roam freely in the stacks. You know, don't tell them what to read. Just let them follow their desires.
Because reading is wonderful. There's The Atlantic had a piece that you wrote, or perhaps it was written about you, Emily Dickinson's Mysterious You, the poem Wild Nights taught the novelist Emma Donoghue about sexuality, ambiguity, and intimacy. How so?
Well, my mother used to recite me Emily Dickinson poems, in my teens in particular, I got very interested in and fond of the poetry of Emily Dickinson, partly because of her backstory. You know, she had this mysterious life withdrawn from the world. I mean, I'm very sociable myself, but these sort of isolated mystics do intrigue me. You know, how could you know, you possibly conjure up enough excitement alone in a room. You know, they're very different from me, but they intrigue me. And her poetry I found just so wonderfully memorable because it's often about very basic things like a sparrow or a crumb, and yet she'll throw in some abstract word which is very, you know, bizarre and mysterious as well. So it's a real mixture of kind of high and low poetry, and her punctuation is like nobody else's. And above all, the fact that, you know, far from being a jobbing writer out there in the world doing book tours, you know, she was just writing for herself. She just wanted to get the poems right, and then she stuck them under her bed. Her love life was mysterious too. You know, she was clearly very passionate about at least one woman, but probably about several men as well. You know, she's just so hard to pin down. So I find her an endlessly interesting figure.
And why Wild Nights, Wild Nights?
That particular one, it's hard to say. It's got very vivid imagery to do with being a boat, basically a boat that wants to find its harbour. But it's not at all cozy. You know, there's a wonderful ambiguity in the poem where you're never quite sure when the boat has come into harbour. And there's a feeling that, yes, she may say she's longing for the storm to be over, but she's enjoying the storm, too.
Part of this article is quoted where you said, I probably sought out this poem once I knew that I was in love with a girl myself at 14, because there I was in 1980s Ireland, realizing I was a lesbian. I couldn't tell a soul. What's so interesting in was it last year, I guess, Ireland
Equal marriage now. And the key thing is they brought it in by referendum, you know, by popular vote.
So people voted on this.
Remarkable how much my country has changed. It's just thrilling to me. And you know, I think for my writing career, I think it's probably crucial that I realized I was a lesbian in my teens, because you need something to sort of shake you awake and say, you know, Don't kid yourself that you're normal. There's no such thing as normal. You know, everybody's got secrets. Everybody's got worries. Everybody's got something about them that they fear that their friends wouldn't approve of. So I think being a lesbian made me realize that I had this sort of deep down empathy with any groups who are marginalized or made to feel freakish. So in a way, I've written a long series of books now about oddities, you know, about the non-normal and what it's like.
That's Emma Donahue, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. You told me that you love to write, and not all writers say that. I have to say, having interviewed
so many
over the years.
No, it's true. For some of them, it's pulling nails.
It is, but for you, no?
I enjoy it so much. The only problem is that a career kind of builds up a lot of elements which are not the actual writing. You know, there's publicity and there's travel arrangements and there's organizing things and filling in forms. And, you know, sometimes I just wish I could purely write all day. But of course, I also want to be in charge of how my books or my works reach the public. So that involves things like long negotiations about the jacket image. You know, what font should something be in? The jacket blurb, you know, the description of the book. I do long email correspondences with my publishers about exactly how much of the plot to give away. Because, you know, your books can't reach the readers without mechanisms like jacket blurbs and images. So I like to be fully involved in all of that.
And it sounds like you're working on screenplays. You've got a novel about France, I think you're working on. So many balls in the air.
Yes, and my next book is for kids, actually, which is a brand new challenge for me. It's for the sort of 8 to 12-year-old market. It's called The Lotteries Plus One, and it'll be out in the spring. And that was such a wonderful contrast to write alongside The Wonder, because it's contemporary and it's funny and it's full of witticisms. It's just a completely different world from the kind of, you know, religion-soaked bogland landscape of The Wonder. So it's great to have a few projects on the go which are different from each other in tone as well as setting and genre, because, you know, each of them refreshes you in different ways. So I would say I've never had writer's block because I keep it mixed up. I keep it varied.
Oh, interesting. So you've never had those, though. And I know there can be these sort of drought periods for writers.
Well, the thing is, if you feel dry with one particular thing you're working on, you just sneak off and write something else. You know, for me, that's the best approach. Like, at the moment, I have all these different deadlines in the screen world and the fiction world. And yet, you know, the other day, I just decided to spend 3 days working on some brand new project for the future. It felt completely illicit.
And here you are on a book tour. Do you like book tours?
You know, I like each individual event, each individual interview. I love the public events. I love meeting the public. But, you know, the getting up at 4 a.m. to get to the airport, you know, you do feel a bit like, why am I here instead of home with my kids? You know, I have a lot of guilt about being away from my kids.
Emma Donahue, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio
Times.
Thank you. You're very welcome. Emma Donahue, our guest. The book is called The Wonder. It's her latest novel, and she's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.